thank you very much. This has been just so fun to hear all this. And I use the word fun because I swear almost every talk the word fun has come up. Sabrina, you said it so much, and it's so invigorating to see people having fun doing this stuff. So, my name's Colin Hunter. I'm the Director of Communications here. I'm also the co-host of our podcast, Conversations at the Perimeter. This is my other co-host, so please pull out your phones, subscribe. I won't be offended. So today's topic is trees versus forest. The word versus sounds a little bit adversarial. I don't think it's really a either-or affair. I have a hunch that that the topic is a little more nuanced than that. They may be two sides of the same coin, but essentially it's the question of hyper-specificity over a very unique problem versus taking a step back and taking the big picture view. Perimeter Institute itself is kind of a forest in that sense. There's people from all different specialities who have come together under one roof to work together. Before we get into it, I'll just briefly reintroduce our panelists very briefly. We have Donna Strickland at the end, Tony Leggett, Sabrina Pastersky, Tim Shea, and Lauren Hayward. I'm thrilled to chat with all of you. So Donna, I'm going to start with you down at the end. In this metaphor of trees and forests, what kind of arborist are you? Are you a hyper-specific problem solver, or do you need to take a step back, or is there a balance there?
I think it depends on which problem it is. But quite often, since I'm an experimentalist, we spend most of our time thinking about why things don't work. So that can be a big picture globally, why it doesn't work, or much more specific. So it sort of, I think, depends. I think if you think about the nonlinear optics we do, it's probably the bigger picture, and you can bring in more areas of nonlinear optics to describe why the one thing you're working on works. Mm-hmm. But most of my time is spent on why the laser doesn't work.
And Tony, what about you at this stage? Are you...
I think I'm very much a tree person. Mm-hmm. That is, I do like to focus on very specific problems rather than doing a general discussion of all possible cases. I think one thing that I always remember is that, if I'm not mistaken, the transistor was not actually invented by Bardeen, Brattain, and Shockley. It actually appears, or so I'm told, in a paper by a Russian author some years earlier. However, it simply appears as one of 14 different possible cases of a general situation. And so, although strictly speaking, the Russians did write down the prescription for the transistor, they obviously simply didn't recognize its significance. And so it seems to me quite appropriate that it was Bardeen and company who actually got the credit for it. Mm-hmm. And I think this situation very often recurs. I can also give you, if it's interesting, an example from my own research. At a certain point in my attempts to investigate whether quantum mechanics was going to apply on the macroscopic scale or not, I ran into the problem of the so-called dissipative two-state system. Now, this is a problem which has actually cropped up in just about every field of physics, from chemical physics to astrophysics to solid-state impurities, you name it. And there is lots and lots of literature on it. But I and my collaborators decided to focus on the specific question. Let us consider a macroscopic system which has available to it two and only two macroscopic states and is trying to tunnel backwards and forwards between them. And let us assume the simplest kind of environment that we can. And let us just focus on that and see what predictions we can make on that basis. In the end, we were able to make some predictions, but of course, once we made them, we got all sorts of people coming in and saying, oh, well, yes, of course, that was derived by so-and-so and so-and-so many years ago. But it didn't matter, really, because, as I say, we were trying to answer a very specific question. How is the motion of this macroscopic system affected, or the tunneling motion, how is it affected by the presence of dissipation? And I think, essentially, we were able to answer that question in a relatively clean, though I have to say very boring kind of way.
And Sabrina, your the title of your talk contained both the trees and the forest. Where do you situate yourself in this?
So I think that the nature of grad school, at least for me, it seemed to be that you end up becoming a tree. You become very focused, and that's, I guess, how you get hired and things like that. But I'm more optimistic that there's a lot of data if you want to try to see the bigger picture and, like, whatever can help you. It's fun to be able to play the long game now. So fingers crossed you can become less tree-like. Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go to you, Lauren, because you you are a teacher, you're a researcher, and you're an outreach scientist. So you've got a foot, you have 3 feet, one in each area. How do you balance that between your own research and then teaching people?
Well, I have to say, when I'm doing research, I definitely tend to be a tree person. I find it really hard to avoid getting stuck in the trees. I try to remind myself to zoom out, but actually the best trick I have for doing that is the teaching and the outreach, because you need to be explaining that bigger picture to students or to the general public. So this is really the best way I have for making sure that I'm balancing those two aspects.
Mm-hmm. And Tim, how about you? Are you a tree person or are you a forest person?
Yeah, I'd like to strike some balance, or at least go between both the trees and the forests. I mean, I think it's really easy to identify what are the big, you know, open questions, right? The hard part is finding the ones that you can actually make progress on, right? The ones that you can actually carry out some technical calculation to make progress. So I think just going back and forth between the small and large scale is a really important part, right? And another thing I would add is that, you know, another axis besides, you know, small detail and big detail is also level of abstraction and experimental relevance, which is, you know, pretty important in my field of quantum matter, right? So there's again this, you know, really important back and forth where you need to know what experimentalists are actually capable of before deciding, you know, what protocols to propose, right? Mm-hmm. So this is back and forth that's really important.
Yeah, that idea of collaborating within your discipline and beyond your own discipline, you know, that's essentially what Perimeter Institute was created for. You have people from all these different sub-disciplines coming together under one roof. How important is that, even if you're in the weeds on a specific problem, to be surrounded by people who are working on different but perhaps related problems?
Yeah, I mean, I think the best part is just you get inspired by different fields, right? I mean, they have such different concepts and ideas that, you know, I view it as kind of like almost like getting inspired by art or music. Just it's often so different that it's like a fresh way of looking at your own field.
Mm-hmm. And Sabrina, you're our newest faculty member here at Perimeter. Can you speak to that idea of being under the same roof, working together with people in different...
I mean, I love my quantum fields and strings group. I think, like, I'm a little bit more, like, trying to, like, make sure that they're considered just as cool when it comes to fundraising as the quantum matter, because you guys have all of this. And I'm sorry. No. But, no, it's great. It's been lovely being here.
And Donna, can you speak to that idea of working within your own field versus, you know, coming to conferences and meeting people who are outside of your own field?
That's what I think about. You know, I think we all like to go to different types of conferences. Just speaking about conferences, I think we feel at home when we go to the conference that's strictly our own field and we talk to each other, and you really feel like you understand almost everything's being talked about. But then you also want to go to the broad ones and go to talks that are quite different to help get inspired and see what's coming that could be similar but taken from a totally different angle, and quite often leads you to think about it in a totally different way. So I think all of us like to have a little bit our toes in each water.
Mm-hmm. And Tony, we spoke yesterday, and one of the first things you brought up was travel, the importance of getting out of your own institution and traveling to other countries. Can you speak to why that's so important to you?
Well, I think people in different communities, particularly when they have been to some extent isolated, as for example happened with the Russian theoretical physics community before Glasnost and subsequent developments, they develop very specific cultures and ways of thinking about problems, and so it's very useful to experience that firsthand. One example is that I have a or used to, at least when I was working full time at the University of Illinois, I used to have a little group of my students and a few other people who wanted to turn up, and every week or so, one of them would give an informal talk. Of course, whenever we had visitors, we would invite them to come along to the talk. And on one occasion, I had one of my students give a talk, and we had a French visitor come along. And his remark after this talk, it seems that in the American culture, it is quite legitimate to give a talk when you do not understand the first thing that you're talking about. And I said, yes, that's the whole idea, basically. We're trying out these ideas very tentatively and seeing what flies and what doesn't. And apparently, his feeling was, at least within the French tradition, everything was far more organised and stylized, and you didn't really give a talk, even to your own small research group, until you mm-hmm. felt everything was pinned down. It's an interesting difference.
Now, we've all just lived through a two-year experiment of not going anywhere, of staying home and staying on our computer screens and communicating via Zoom, and here we are in person finally. How important is it to actually get out and just talk face to face with people? How does that change the dynamic of doing science? Tim, I'll go for you.
It's okay. Well, to be honest, I think there are some aspects of remaining at home that were rather convenient. beyond that, it's just really stimulating to be face to face, right? I mean, forces you to think faster than sitting in front of a screen, for sure. Mm-hmm. So I think it's mainly that stimulating aspect that's most important in driving new ideas.
Yeah. Lauren, what about you?
Well, I think I have a unique experience of the pandemic because I had a baby at the start of the pandemic, so I was actually on maternity leave for the majority of those 2 years that you're referring to. So I think the change was maybe in some sense more dramatic. I went from spending most of my time talking to someone who couldn't say anything back to being surrounded by a large community here again and being able to have more of those discussions. But if I think maybe more generally about the difference between working from home versus here, there's definitely a huge difference. I mean, the number of conversations you'll end up having just by running into people in the hallway or just while you're getting a coffee or something like that, those are not conversations that I would necessarily initiate by Zoom, mm-hmm. but they can really be transformative.
And how important is that spontaneity and the serendipity of just bumping into someone rather than having a Zoom meeting booked for a specific time? Anyone?
Yeah, I think it's pretty important. It's actually one thing I rather missed on transferring from Sussex in the UK to UIUC. In Sussex, we used to have a regular tea time where people would just come along, mingle totally informally. It was no sort of organisation whatever to it. And you'd often find, I'd often find myself sitting down next to my particle physics colleague or whatever, and very often the problems would sort of come up spontaneously, in which we had joint interests. I found on going to the University of Illinois that things were much more regimented. Not officially regimented, but sort of self-regimented, in that when I, at one point, I made a suggestion that, again, we should do something similar. We should all get together for coffee at some stated time in the afternoon. And people who wanted to come, could come, and those who didn't want to come, didn't. And the particle physics experimentalist, I remember, told me, oh, that's never going to work. We always have a coffee among our group in our office, and we never go out to mingle generally. It just isn't in the culture, as it were. Mm-hmm.
Now, I think it can be argued that academia can reward really specific research on a specific topic because you can write a specific paper in a specific specialized journal and get funding and grants. How do you balance that sort of safer approach versus taking a big risk on an area that maybe is less well-defined, especially maybe for young researchers? How do you choose between the high-risk, out-there research and the more focused research? Donna?
I think it probably... first of all, speaking as an experimentalist, we're somewhat limited to the equipment we have, so we can only sometimes go so far out unless... it's pretty hard to get a grant person to give you totally different equipment if you don't already have a track record in that. So I think to some extent we're more limited unless we start to collaborate with other people with their equipment. But I think there's, again, reasons for doing both. I think certainly for my own field, I quite often am just thinking about the laser and how I can make a laser nobody else has. And then I wait for somebody else to say to me, you know what, I'd like to use that laser. I could come on over. And then I learn their field just because they want to use my laser, and it somehow works that way.
Mm-hmm.
But
actually, Lauren, the SCI program that you took and instruct in, it gives a very broad range of theoretical physics in a year. I'm sure there's students here that could attest that there's a lot of it. can you speak to that idea of an early career scientist just getting the full breadth of science versus, you know, specializing right away in a master's?
Yeah, this is something I find myself talking with students about a lot. And in particular, I have to say, I see a lot of students who are really hard on themselves about this aspect because there are some students who, like me, are natural tree people. And so they like to specialize in something. And then they see other students who are moving around between a lot of different areas, and they compare themselves a lot to that. And I always have to say, I think that science needs all kinds of people. We've heard today we need theorists, we need experimentalists, we need computational scientists, we need those experts as well as early career people. I think we also really need tree people and we need forest people. And so the advice I always like to give is that if you find yourself as a tree person, make sure you surround yourself by some forest people, because I think that's really going to be necessary to your work. I know for myself, as a tree person, if I were working with only other tree people on a research paper, it would never get done. We would always find more details that we could explore and look at and add to this paper. But when you're working with forest people, they'll start to say, there's other big questions to look at. We need to wrap this up and move on to the next thing. So for me, that's a really essential part.
Right. Sabrina, were you always dedicated to celestial holography, or did you take the big picture first and then specify?
I would say that it's more by chance too. I mean, like, you somehow bet on, I mean, at some point it's kind of crazy how much your lucky things work out or not. I mean, because it came out of this the PhD research, so a lot to my advisor there. I don't know. I think it's, I would definitely say that it just, I guess, happened where I happened, like, My advice, I guess, to anybody who's younger is, like, let's try to be more informed about the big questions and pick where you want to go. And that's what I love about a master's program, because you're getting into grad school after you've had some breadth and had a chance to really apply to a PhD program and doing exactly what you know to do. So I think that I'm lucky it all worked out, but the way it was set up would be, like, once you kind of go a track, you either have to, like, bet on it as a long-term investment or... pivot at a time where you're not sure. So I'm just very happy that it's worked out nicely.
Mm-hmm. Tim?
Yeah, again, I would say just a balance between the two is really critical. Like, at least for me, I need to see that bigger picture to get interested and motivated enough to actually work out through the nitty-gritty details, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that's just a personal thing. I can also imagine people that, you know, really love the technical aspect or the challenge of satisfaction of, you know, smaller problem solving before seeing what that calculation might be good for. Right? Mm-hmm. I think that's what Tony was alluding to with the transistor example, I guess. Right. Well, yeah, just, you know, first just, you know, doing the technical calculation, enumerating everything, and then before seeing what these things might be good for. I think both modes of operation are, you know, are valuable.
Mm-hmm. There is so much information every single day. In physics alone, you go on the archive every morning, I assume there's new papers in your field, in every field. With so much to take in, how do you balance it? How do you know what to read carefully versus what to skim? Sabrina, I'll start with you.
This is 8:30, except for on Mondays, or like 9. At night. So I guess what I would do is, honestly, it's a little bit bad where you essentially, I guess, go for the things that you understand better, because then when you read it, it's more fun because you understand the details and appreciate it. I would not say I'm the best at filtering in a way that I want to be in the future. It gets more and more fun, I think, as you get older. I think it was one funny thing is I had Brown. They would have all of the grad students have to look at the archive every day. And when I was younger, and you'd hear people doing this, you'd just feel ashamed. You're not interested in the archive every day. And eventually, you are really interested in what's on the archive every day. And so it's really fun to see how the kind of ideals that you wish, as a good researcher, I wish I was at that, can come about rather than be something that you're just forced to do. So I enjoy reading, looking at what's on the archive, but I'm ashamed to say I still only care a lot when it's either someone I know or related to what I understand well. So, mm-hmm.
Donna, can I ask you the same question? How do you stay on top of a subject?
I probably don't anymore. but I think it's more meandering for me. You know, I meander through what I'm interested in, and then for whatever reason. And I would say now, if I'm not just touring giving talks, I'm writing letters of recommendation for someone else to get an award. And you know, sometimes the field isn't that close to me. So next thing you know, you have to really study their field, and you start thinking, isn't that, I didn't know that, I didn't know that, I didn't know that. And it gets you a little bit further away from you normally go. But I seem to just meander.
Can it be overwhelming, the sheer amount of information on any given subject, to know what to pay attention to and what not?
Yeah, so I think this is where the in-person aspect of science is really important, because, you know, at least for me, it's really valuable, say, over lunch, just to talk to colleagues, postdoc students. I mean, these are people whose opinions you respect, mm-hmm. and often you'll learn about the very interesting papers just directly from them, without having to, you know, go through all these yourself, right? Obviously, you'll miss a couple here and there, but overall, that's a really valuable tool.
And I want to add to that too, because I made the mistake in grad school. I legit, for at some point, was decided I had done a couple of papers and wanted to learn more, because I was always embarrassed by how little I understood at talks, yada yada. So I would just read things and I don't know. I would pile up everything. I'd print out everything I could, even print out the books on Springer and print them out, and I have this pile and pile and pile. It grew to 3 feet tall of things, just to show myself I'm learning something. I gotta be learning something if I'm reading all this crap. And a little stuff moves to the top or whatever. And then I'd put stickers on the textbooks that I read cover to cover, and it's just what am I doing? You try really hard to be let's pick up a chemistry book. Oh, cool. It's all basically condensed matter physics in the beginning. That's fun. At some point you don't observe things, versus then when you realize I know something technical, and I can try to basically do a branding exercise to turn some of the stuff in the bootstrap papers into a celestial language. And you learn so much more by just actually caring and applying something than you do just trying to acquire expertise. That is almost, it's embarrassing, but also reassuring, because at some point when you're in this pile that's taller than you in the desk, and you have nothing to show for it, it's oh my God. But at some point, just do what you like and keep, it's fine.
Yeah. Lauren, with teaching and doing outreach and your own research, how do you choose, how are there enough hours in the day?
Well, I'm glad to hear, Donna, that you also don't keep up on it all, because I definitely don't keep up on it all. I also have to, maybe this is somewhat of a side note, but I think we actually need better systems and algorithms to help us find what papers we need to read when we're new to a field, and help us with those kinds of recommendations of what we should be reading to stay current in the field. But in any sense, I agree with a lot of the points that were already said. I think, even if you can't read all of those papers that you want to read, just reading the abstracts, or even just reading the titles, or going to talks, and maybe you are okay with, you just become okay with not understanding it all, but you slowly build up an awareness of the words that come up more and more often that you don't understand. And this really makes a difference. But especially when you're new to a field, I think it can sometimes feel like you're not making progress, because every time you start to read about one of those things that you want to learn, you often become aware of maybe 10 other things that you don't understand. So what you know grows, but what you don't know also grows. So I like Sabrina's technique of keeping track of what you've read, because it's kind of a way to remember the progress you're making. You know, you need to reflect on your progress and not just think about the things you don't know.
But now I would say, like, if I could do it again, that's what I'm trying to do with these, like, clusters of people, is I want to basically try to see, like, what are the things people actually are working on, look at zoom out, and then at some point it's easy enough to see the canon, like you're saying. Like, I think it wouldn't be that hard to decide, like, what you need to learn, the bare minimum to get to something, and I think that's more valuable than just...
Yeah. But I just think this is one of the things conferences do for us, too, is that conferences try to help group things, and so that you can go and pretty quickly see where the hot topics are and what the which way the fields are moving. And so it helps a lot just guiding you, if as long as you're sitting there and agree. I mean, sometimes you're sitting there going, why is everybody going down this road? I don't get it. But you don't have to follow always. But I think this is one of the main reasons for conferences, and one of the main reasons, I think, for going in person to conferences, so you can sample a bit more.
Mm-hmm. I imagine that if you go to a conference in any area of specialty, that you're going to feel a bit of imposter syndrome if somebody else is further ahead than you, or has been in the field longer. How do you sort of cope with that feeling of I'm behind the curve on this subject, or I need to learn more about this specific thing? Tim?
Okay, I guess that's kind of related to something I wanted to comment on regarding the previous question. So yeah, I guess in general, it's probably not good to try to follow the big mainstream topic, right? So that, mm-hmm. that's why I think the local environment is really essential. Mm-hmm. Because there you're dealing with, you know, you're trusting that the people you talk to, the colleagues, the postdocs, et cetera, they have a good taste in the field, right? Like they're not simply identifying the papers that are hot at the moment, right? And so that type of good taste that you should be trying to pursue, not the mainstream, right? So I wouldn't worry about trying to catch up to what's hot at the moment, right? You just follow your own taste. What do you find interesting, and what your local environment finds interesting? Mm-hmm.
Now I assume that all of you get stuck. Physics, fundamental physics, is notoriously difficult. It's not rocket science. It's what comes before the rocket. And so when you get, you're deep into a problem and you're stuck, this is a question for each of you. How do you unstick yourself? How do you become unstuck? Don't all jump at the opportunity.
I think that is when you start having conversations with other people. I mean, I'm sure there's times when you unstick yourself, but I think it's easier if you get somebody else's opinion, or somebody who's working on something close but not exactly, or hopefully if you can't figure it out, your student can, and if your student can't figure it out, hopefully you can, or somebody else close by. But I don't know, I usually think, and I say this a lot, that people have to remember that physics is still a team sport. We think that it's just one person, and we give Einstein a credit for a lot, but I mean, Einstein was writing letters back and forth too. He wasn't just sitting all by himself, thinking all by himself.
I think that's a good point. There's sort of the misconception of the lone genius struggling away at the blackboard with a pile of crumpled up papers in the corner. How important is it for you to just reach out and ask a colleague for advice, or have the opportunity to bounce a question off somebody?
It's very important. And the thing, that's what's nice about Perimeter compared to other places I've been at. I feel like people are less embarrassed. Like, it's amazing how the culture can affect how you feel doing research. Because when you are stuck, if you can just have conversations, even just actually having other people interested in the same thing around you, where you can, I guess, bounce it off and improve it, or even just force you to go through something because you have a meeting and you have to talk about it. Having an environment where, like, not knowing something is okay, and you're, like, the point is how quickly you can learn, rather than shaming which somehow you, even if it's not intentional, it's amazing how you can accidentally curate that in certain places that are otherwise really good. That's what I've loved about Perimeter. So I would say talking to people gets you out of it, and then also who, like, so there's something really nice about Perimeter that I haven't seen other places where you really feel like it's okay to be learning something, I think.
Mm-hmm. Tony, in your career, have you balanced the solitary work of intense concentration versus getting out and talking to others?
I think it's certainly very useful to simply have colleagues who will, as it were, listen to you, so that even if they are nowhere near yours, if their sphere of expertise is nowhere near yours, nevertheless, you can you can explain the problem or try to explain the problem to them. Mm-hmm. The mere act of trying to explain it to another person, I think, very often clarifies it.
Mm-hmm. And what about talking to non-scientists, talking to, say, school students or people who have no involvement in...
Again, very useful. And actually, one of the things I do find interesting when traveling is that in some countries, I won't name any names here, but in some countries, students seem very inhibited about asking questions which may possibly display their own lack of knowledge, whereas in others, they're quite free in doing so. And I think the latter is obviously much more helpful both to them and to you.
Mm-hmm.
I always think that's more of an age thing than a country thing, right? You go to elementary schools, and they have their hands up all the time. They want to answer every question because they're not at all worried about being wrong. There was no such thing as being wrong. And you go to a middle school where puberty has reached, and you are so afraid of being wrong. And this is the hump that we have to get over, that we have to, you know, get past that stage, or either we let them have that stage, but then somehow bring it back that it's okay to be wrong.
But it could be more socialization than actually growing up, in the sense that, like, kids are not told, like, they're dumb because they don't know something. People appreciate that they're children and they're learning, and I think that you can socialize out a lot of, like, eagerness to ask questions if you create an environment that does that.
Now, how much of a scientist's job is saying, I don't know, I don't get this, and reaching out to others?
I mean, honestly, the people who do, as you can see, they actually ask questions. Like, that's a more efficient way to learn, and I think once you realize it's more efficient, even if you look like an idiot, and it'll help you in the long run, just, yeah, you can get over a lot of pride.
This would be one thing I would like to have changed in our education system, because our whole education system until graduate school is testing what students have learned from the past. And so it's always about what do you know. And, of course, once you start in grad school, it's what you don't know is important. And so I think I would like to see that changed in the education system so that they understand all the way along that scientists are always trying to figure out what they don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to add that I think Google is a really great resource when you know what question you're going to ask, but talking to other people is how you figure out what that question is. So I think it's really important.
Now, I'm curious what non-scientific pursuits each of you has that helps you get out of the hyper-specific problem and truly see the big picture of life and the other things that matter. Do you have hobbies or things you do to reset your brain? Sabrina, I'll go with you first.
Oh, I used to have, oh my God, I've gone through hobbies. So my attitude is I like to try to see how hard it is to become, like, do something poorly and then be able to appreciate the expertise in that or not, for whatever the conclusion is there. I'm shitty at everything, but I do have in my office like the piano and a guitar and a 3D printer, because I don't know, I just like to see like actually what goes into making something. And also it's really fun to see yourself, even if you want to do something pretty poorly, like how you can learn without consciously trying to learn the thing. And so it kind of, I guess, emphasizes how you should be doing problems instead of just reading things to learn something, when you can like see yourself visibly getting better at something. So there's that, but my current hobby is this, like finding all the string theorist type stuff.
Mm-hmm. I said non-scientific.
But that's not scientific. Oh, come on. I'm not going to write some sort of like, I mean, like I'm not going to go on that archive category.
Well, I happen to know about Tim that not only is he a quantum scientist, but he's also played violin at Carnegie Hall. Radio City Music?
Well, not as a soloist, but as part of an orchestra.
You're being humble. Can you tell us about your musical life?
Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, I've played violin for much of my life, since like age of five, and it's definitely been a great complementary aspect of physics. Again, it relates to the question of the previous one of what do you do when you get stuck? Well, it's just helpful to remain active at some constructive aspect of life, right? And so violin has been, you know, one of those things that just, you know, reminds you that the world is beautiful, you're stuck on a problem, but maybe at some point you can, you know, see some of this beauty of the world, right? So it's definitely been like a inspiring diversion from physics. Mm-hmm.
You've actually combined the two. I've seen a video. Can you tell us about the video that you made at MIT?
Yeah, so I think at that point I was taking a class from Frank Wilczek about topology in physics, and somehow randomly one of my friends is making a documentary about, I guess, PhD life at MIT, which may not be the best topic for a documentary, but in any case, somehow it was she had a good idea of kind of juxtaposing Frank's very nice lectures with me playing Bach Chacon, and so that was kind of a neat experience.
And Tony, what do you do for fun when you're not doing science?
Well, I find whenever I travel, at least, then trying to learn at least a minimum of the local language is very helpful. I mean, often, in many cases, I end up literally only knowing absolute minimum. But nevertheless, somehow it's a different part of your mind you seem to be exercising doing that. And so mm-hmm. I find it is a very, very welcome change from doing physics.
Mm-hmm. One of my favorite sites in Waterloo over the past decade, when Tony had a regular summer teaching gig at the Institute for Quantum Computing, we'd always see him riding his bike back and forth to IQC. You're a cyclist and a hiker.
Yeah.
Does that help you disconnect from the research?
Yes, I think so, yes. So actually, if I wanted, at least when I was much younger, when I wanted to take my mind off physics, for example, in the last few months before my PhD, I found that the best, by the very best way of taking it off was rock climbing.
Hmm.
I mean, if you're perched on one toe over 3,000 feet of space and you have to figure out your next move, you're not going to be thinking about anything else.
Mm-hmm. Donna, how about you? How do you?
Because I only tried gears? That once, and when I got back down to the ground, I kissed the ground and said, "I'll never leave again." No, I'm very one-dimensional, and the older I get, the more I like to do absolutely nothing. So I have a cottage, and in the summer, you will find me in my floaty chair, anchored with my sister, just talking away.
That sounds wonderful. How about you, Lauren?
Well, I really like spending time outside. I like hiking, cycling, camping, things like that. And I'm sorry to be that mom who's going to talk about her child again, but spending time with my family is definitely number one for me. And just because we're here for Day of Discovery, I have to say, if you want to surround yourself by as many discoveries as possible, have a toddler, because he's discovering new things and having breakthroughs multiple times per day. And it's just really a joy to watch that.
Does that actually sort of reset your thinking to look at the world through different eyes?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, again, as a tree person, when I'm doing work, I can get really hard on myself and get really stuck. And my next idea never comes from just driving myself crazy over a piece of paper or the blackboard. It always comes when I take a step back, whether it's just, you know, getting a snack or a cup of tea or something, or, you know, doing one of those hobbies or spending time with my son. That's always when the next idea strikes.
Mm-hmm. And Tim, you're a father as well.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
I completely agree. I mean, it definitely, you know, makes you think about more first principles approach toward everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, well, I imagine you get all sorts of questions that haven't occurred to you since you were a toddler.
Yeah, well, she's not talking that much yet,
but, yeah. It'll come. Well, I want to leave a lot of time for questions because this is the last chance we'll have with this these esteemed guests on this stage. So I want to hand it over to the audience to ask them questions.
Theory. What's your opinion on math? Like, let's go. I mean, to me, if anything, there's something beautiful about something just being self-consistent and true in that sense, and it's a pure truth than what an experiment's able to measure, and so that's why I love it. But that's not to say that it's like, to me, you know, it's really cool when like the, like, you know, trying to understand the fundamental laws of nature can be coupled to things that affect like people or engineering, like in shorter time scales. And at some point, though, that's going to decouple, and that doesn't mean that suddenly you shouldn't be doing these like very like abstract things, because it's amazing how far consistency can take you. And I think that it, I mean, even if you just try to like see like how, like, I mean, like if we're doing tests of GR now and how long ago that was, like, I mean, like we're the future in some sense.
I think it's very much a matter of personal taste and so forth, but personally, I'm very much happier when I have a when I have to try to do the theory for a problem which is actually being worked on experimentally by my colleagues. And that's why I think I probably stay in low-temperature physics, because that is certainly one area where you can make a conjecture, and within, often months, but certainly within a couple of years, this conjecture can be tested by your experimental colleagues. And I find that very satisfying, and many, quite a few times during my career I've been able to do this and been proved either right or wrong. Mm-hmm.
Do we have other questions?
No.
No. It keeps me up at night sometimes. Don't worry about it. Just embrace it. I'm done.
You're done. Don't be shy. Last one. With a microphone with battery.
Last chance. Oh, there's a question back there.
Thank you. So once upon a time, not that long ago in my PhD, my advisor told me that a theorist's job is fundamentally to be wrong. You can have a beautiful theory, and it can be incredibly self-consistent, and it can just happen to not be the universe that we live in. Right? That doesn't mean it was a bad theory, but it means that you maybe move on to the next thing or something like that. Can any of you tell me about a time that you were wrong and it was really great? An easy one to end on.
I still don't like the preface of that, no. I mean, we're wrong all the time. I think, but I mean, a lot of us are. I mean, even, I would say that, just because experiment, like, so what's the value of a theory if you're saying it has to be tied to experiments? You have some theory that predicts something, the person measures it, and then there's some, like, assumption that you made into that where there's, like, a more fundamental theory. Like, we're all just approximating the truth,
And the nice thing about certain theories is that it's really more the structure and the self-consistency of that thing. And to the extent that that's more true than like anything that you're going to maybe experimentally measure that's valid at the scales that you're able to probe, like, I think that's more beautiful. And I think that that's, like, well, sorry, that's a preface to your question. But as far as when it's wrong and it's beautiful, I don't know, probably too many examples to come up with a good one. Well, I'll try to think of other people.
And does anybody have an example of being wonderfully wrong? Tony?
Yeah, I think, yes, I fairly early on in the history of high temperature cuprate superconductivity, I suddenly had a thought which seemed to me very beautiful and elegant, and which I thought might explain at least some of the properties of the cuprate superconductors. And I was really pretty excited about this. But then I started working out the consequences, and it gradually became clear that it's not going to be at all easy to do experiments which would either verify or falsify this theory, but I kept working on it. Eventually, I did manage to get a leading experimental group interested, but of course, when they did the experiment, what came out was not exactly a complete mess, but I mean, the experimentalists were excellent, but it sort of turned out that my theory was, well, it wasn't exactly wrong, but it wasn't exactly right either. And in the end, the picture which emerged was very murky and much, much less exciting than I'd originally thought. That's okay. I mean, I think it probably contributed something at least to the development of the subject, and not what I'd originally hoped it would.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think often what we see is the final product. We see the success, and we don't see the failed attempts that went into the success. Donna, I'll just ask you that: have you experienced enough failure to truly appreciate success?
Well, I do appreciate success when it happens. Yes, because I've had more failures than successes. So. But I'm not trying to do theories or anything. I mean, we try a lot of experiments that go nowhere too, and you just have to finally say it's going nowhere. But I did like, you know, for the last several years, I've been trying to figure out what these extra lines in our spectrum are, and I keep asking for theorists for help. And then I said, now I've won a Nobel Prize, maybe someone will help me. And then somebody did. So, but he claims it's not because I won the Nobel Prize. But we're still trying. But I will tell you, one of the toughest things is that theorists and experimentalists will see the same problem completely differently. I remember like the self-focusing, which I sort of explained here, was what I did for my postdoc. And when I went to do my interview job talk at Livermore, I knew that one of the main theorists doing it was there. And I found it very funny, and I'm in the same boat now with the student doing the theory on my stuff, that we see it totally different, and it's hard to see her theory and my experimental results saying the same thing. But I thought I had a very clear picture of, because it was the spatial part in the spectrum, but I could see space and color, and he couldn't figure it out, and he had some action angle phase diagram, and he was so clear to him, and we knew we were talking about the very same thing, but we could not understand each other. And so that's one of the things I find very frustrating between trying to get theory and experiment to get together, because we really do see it sometimes, the very same thing, totally differently.
Last question, anyone? Well, in that case, thank you to all of you, and thank you very much to the panelists for a wonderful talk.